Hi, my name is Jennifer Mitzman, and I am an assistant professor of emergency medicine at The Ohio State University and an assistant professor of pediatrics at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. Today, I am going to be talking about a time in my life that was difficult, where I struggled with being a second victim in hopes of destigmatizing something that some of you may have experienced in your careers as well. My day started very similarly to many others. I arrived at the emergency department for a 7 o'clock a.m. shift, took sign out and sent my very tired partners home, and began my workday. Around 7:30, I got a frantic call on those little portable phones that we all love, and the person on the other end of the line said, "We need you right now in room X." I thought that this was a little bit strange because that room is not normally covered by my zone in the emergency department. It is a room where we preferentially deliver babies in our emergency department, although like many emergency departments around the country, our first preference, of course, is not to deliver any babies in our emergency department. It is also where we have all of our equipment to take care of moderately or severely ill or injured children, which is also something that we don't see a lot of at that particular work site. So I went to the room because when your nurses ask you to do something right now, you should do it. And went in thinking that perhaps I would see someone with a pediatric patient that they wanted my help with. I did not see a child, but rather an adult male. He was wearing only a C-collar. Someone was performing chest compressions on him. My resident was gathering intubation equipment at the head of the bed, and a pharmacist and nurse were standing near a crash cart drawing up medications. I took that split-second survey of the room that we all learned to do early in our careers as emergency medicine physicians, and I stepped in to begin running the code. In between ordering the doses of epinephrine, reminding my resident to open the C-collar and optimize his airway view, and doing all of those other things that are second nature to running a code as an attending, pieces of information began filtering into my brain. And all of a sudden, I realized that the reason there had been no EMS trauma in code to warn us of this patient's arrival, and the reason he belonged to me and not the attending who would normally be covering this room, was that this patient already was my patient. Although we had never met, I took sign out on this young man about 15 minutes before he attempted to hang himself in our emergency department. I still had a code to run, so I attempted to stuff that realization down and press forward. We achieved return of spontaneous circulation, which in layman's terms means our patient got a pulse back. However, it was clear from the labs and the imaging done afterwards that while he was alive in this moment, he would ultimately not survive his injuries. We got him stable-ish, as stable as he could be, and upstairs to the medical intensive care unit. And then I did what all of my emergency medicine colleagues and I always do following traumatic situations. I went back to work. I shoved all of this information into a tiny compartment in my brain, and I went back to see all of the patients who had built up in the emergency department while I was in this one individual room. Many of those patients who really don't understand that their emergency and that kind of emergency aren't just interchangeable. There was some low-level chatter throughout the department about the situation, and I noticed a few more people than usual who wear suits under their white coats, but by and large, the day moved forward not that differently from many other days. A few hours later, I received a call from the social worker that the patient's parents had arrived, and they had a lot of questions. First and foremost, why were people directing them to a medical intensive care unit when, as far as they understood, their child was in the emergency department for a psychiatric problem? I, too, had a lot of questions about what had transpired that morning, but the social worker and I went to meet them and attempted to explain what had happened. I told them what I knew of the events while acknowledging that there were still a lot of things I did not know. I disclosed to them that I anticipated their child would die. At one point, I became somewhat tearful, and his mom reached over to me, patted my hand, and said, "Honey, I've been waiting for this call for 15 years, and I'm really sorry you had to be the one to make it." I don't know as a person or as a parent how she found it within herself to share that information with me in what I imagine was one of her very worst moments, But I do know that her bit of forgiveness became a bright white sliver of light in what were very dark times ahead for me. I went home for my shift and put on a smile for my own children. After they went to sleep, I shared very briefly with my husband what had happened, and I went to bed early. Where I proceeded, of course, not to sleep a wink. I heard in my head over and over the sign-out information, the code situation, and the parent conversation. I reread the chart at 11 p.m., 1 a.m., 2:30 a.m., looking for some piece of information that, had I known it earlier, would have enabled me to prevent this tragedy. Or perhaps this was all a nightmare and none of this had ever really happened. Of course, I found no such information, and while nightmarish, the events were very much real. I was wide awake at 6 a.m. when my alarm clock went off and I had to go back to work. I don't know many things in this life with absolute certainty, but I can tell you that I had absolutely no business being in the emergency department that day. But I went. It honestly never occurred to me not to go. I know to people in other professions that sounds kind of crazy, but I know of colleagues who have worked fevering, vomiting, laboring. And so I did what we have been acculturated to do. I went back to work. I tried to take care of my new patient while being quite distracted by my previous one. I had to step into a few supply rooms to regain my composure throughout the day. I had hospital administrators who prior to that day would never have been able to pick me out of a lineup as their employee stop by and say things like, "Jennifer, the hospital's behind you, and we understand exactly what you're going through." Something we all knew was total BS. And to top it all off, my 3 o'clock relief, not known for being the most sensitive in our group of physicians, walked in and said to a room full of people, including students and residents, "Well, I heard you didn't kill anyone today. Would you like to go home?" I was horrified and embarrassed. I felt literally ill. I somehow made it through sign out and ran to my office to finish charting and ugly cry in private. While I was there, I had 2 visitors and a phone call, interestingly, all from men. 2 of them were partners, not ones I'm particularly close to then or now, who shared with me stories of patients they had had under their care who either attempted to or completed suicide. And one of them was our assistant medical director, who said, "I took the liberty of making you a counseling appointment tomorrow morning. It's not mandatory, it's not coming from any official capacity, but what happened to you sucked, and I think you should talk to somebody about it." His words weren't that dissimilar from my husband's the night before, and I thought about how I had felt at work that day, and I kept the appointment. I went to that appointment and to many more that followed at the strange hours of day and night that fit into an emergency medicine attending's life. I worked through transitions back and forth from my various work sites, through my next patient who hanged himself, and through the Grand Inquisition, otherwise known as the Sentinel Event Committee. And as I talked to my counselor and to others, I did some research, and what I found was actually quite surprising to me. We are empowered from an early stage of our medical career to stop the surgeon who's about to lop off the wrong leg, and we should do that. We do annual reviews of appropriate patient restraints and fall prevention. Yet 10 to 15% of Sentinel events reported to the Joint Commission are actually triggered by a patient suicide, and nobody says a word about it. Until this happened to me, I had no idea, and I speak to professional colleagues regularly who still have no idea. So here I was in this 10 to 15%, and I decided that I was going to work to change the conversation. Those 2 partners and almost all of the people I have since met who have been touched by this topic shared their stories with me with a caveat. "I don't talk about this, but please don't tell anyone in my department or in our department, because they don't know and they wouldn't understand. I'm afraid people will think I'm a bad doctor." And while I respect the silence of those individuals, I'm a talker. I knew that talking about this was the only way that I would move forward. I decided that I was going to talk to my students, my residents, and my colleagues. And in doing so, I have been able to integrate this experience so that it's a part, but only one part, of my professional medical history. I know the data and statistics well enough to know that there are people listening who have been or who will be touched by patient suicide. I think that as physicians, we deserve to be able to talk about this, not just behind closed doors and hidden one-on-one sessions, but de-identified in appropriate forums such as this. And I believe that when it comes to mental health, both for our patients and for us, it is time to break the silence.